Hello, and a very warm welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast. My name is Simon Brew from Film Stories magazine, and this is a regular podcast celebrating one of the biggest and deepest film libraries in the world. Studio Canal's extensive library of over 6,000 films brings together cinema from around the globe. Amongst the choices, there's brilliant modern films such as Another Round and Blue Valentine, The Darkness of You Were Never Really Here and Blood Simple. Or how about some C-set blockbusters such as U571 or Cutthroat Island? We're doing our very best to explore it all in this podcast. This time, we're jumping into the world of Ealing Studios, in particular two of its most loved films of all time. The Lavender Hill Mob and Kind Hearts and Coronets. I'm delighted too to be joined by Dr. Benedict Morrison. He's a senior lecturer in literature, film, television and queer studies at the University of Exeter. He's also a huge fan of Ealing Studios, and I'll be chatting to him once we've played you a little taste of Ealing with a clip from the Lavender Hill Mob.
The police of every county have instructions to leave no stone unturned in their nationwide search. Every possible clue is being investigated, however small and unimportant it may appear on the surface. The Yard are confident of ultimate success, because anyone who traffics in stolen gold will find it's too hot to handle.
Benedict, hello, and welcome to the Studio Canal Presents podcast.
Hello, thank you very much for having me. It's a delight to be here.
So Benedict, before we get going, we ask every guest who comes onto this podcast to tell us a little film fact about themselves. And so I was going to ask you, what's the first film you remember seeing?
Now that you ask that question, I realise that I have no memories at all. Although there is one film that I do recall watching as a very young child. To be honest, too young a child. I don't know how my parents could have been so irresponsible. At about the age of 5 or 6, I remember watching Jaws.
Oh, lovely.
Yeah, lovely. I don't know if I thought that it was going to be some fun romp with a fish, but I do remember that having watched it, I was so distressed and traumatised that I was unable to take a bath for what felt like years. I think it probably caused quite a significant hygiene problem in our household, because the idea of being in water was absolutely chilling to me. And I don't think I went in the sea again until I was in my 30s. So it demonstrated from a very early moment how powerful film is, what an impact it can have.
So could you introduce Ealing Studios to those who may have heard the name but might not recognise the significance?
One of the things that I love about Ealing Studios is how diverse its output was. Although it's very famous for a series of comedies, it also made films of every imaginable genre. It is the oldest continuously operating film studio in the world. There was a film studio on that site since 1902. It really came into its own in the 1920s under the leadership of Basil Dean, where it made a series of star comedies featuring comedians such as George Formby and Gracie Fields. And then from 1938, under the leadership of Michael Balkan, who is really the name that is most synonymous in most people's imagination with Ealing Studios, it established itself, first of all, as a very important machine for producing propaganda during the war, and then, in the post-war period, making a series of comedies which really, to a large extent, defined then and continue to define British comedy at its most excellent, even now.
So you mentioned Sir Michael Balkan and hinted at some of the key personnel at Ealing during that post-war period. Are there any other names that we should be keeping an eye out for?
Yeah, absolutely. One of the writers who's very associated with the studio and who's going to be very important when we're talking about the Lavender Hill Mob is T.E.B. Clarke, Tibby Clarke, who wrote a number of both dramas and comedies, but really a number of their most famous celebrated comedies. There is a kind of mistaken idea, I think, that Tibby Clarke is responsible for the really cozy feel that people, I think, mistakenly associate with Ealing. I think Tibby Clarke is mischievous. I think Tibby Clarke is daring. I think Tibby Clarke is, at moments, dark and dangerous. And I think that's something that I hope we'll have a chance to talk about when we talk about the Lavender Hill Mob. There are also a host of directors. There are some directors who really rank amongst the very greatest that this country has produced, including Robert Hamer, who directed Kind Hearts and Coronets, which we'll be talking about, but also Alexander McKendrick. But also directors like Charles Crichton, who do not get enough credit. He directed The Lavender Hill Mob, and I think that there is not a single frame of The Lavender Hill Mob that is less than perfect.
I remember when John Cleese was making A Fish Called Wonder, and he was absolutely insistent, A, that Charles Crichton directed it, and B, that he was willing to be the standby director so that he could have Charles Crichton come back and direct a film.
Fantastic. And of course, he was then recognised by the American Academy with a nomination.
Properly, for the
rightly.
Yeah.
So a lot of these directors really got a reputation for being just, you know, jobbing decent directors, but actually they were remarkable talents. It's also worth mentioning Douglas Slocum, who again we will mention later.
I will come to him.
One of the great cinematographers in the history of cinema, not just British cinema.
Before we get to a couple of the films specifically, you've talked about, I just wonder if you can explain this a little bit for me. You've talked about Ealing and its, quote, comedies of rubble. What do you mean by comedies of rubble?
What I mean, I suppose, is comedies that engaged with the landscape of ruination, desolation, architectural ruin that defined particularly urban spaces in this country after the Second World War. I find it interesting that there's a kind of, I think at times, a rather condescending attitude towards comedy. And there is a, I think, a problematic idea that other countries in the wake of the Second World War made proper cinema.
Yeah.
Italy made neorealism, people walking through rubble looking miserable. Whereas the urban landscape of ruination in London and other urban spaces in this country often became the sites of comedies.
Yes.
For example, what is often credited as being the first classic Ealing comedy, though this can be challenged, is Hue and Cry from 1947, also directed by Charles Crichton and written by Tibby Clark. Much of it takes place in bomb sites and ruined spaces, spaces where it's difficult to tell whether a building has been destroyed or one is in the process of being put up. But nevertheless, there's a kind of contingency to them, a kind of anarchy to them.
Yeah.
Importantly, Michael Balkan, when describing the comedies, described them as a form of mild anarchy. Precisely what one of these bomb sites becomes is a space where children and others can play, can dream, can imagine how they're going to rebuild it. We see this also in Passport to Pimlico. We see this also in The Lavender Hill Mob. As they drive and move and play through these spaces, which appear to be scarred urban sites, but instead become places of dream and places which are extremely funny. And I don't think that making comedies after the war was a kind of soft or easy option. I think it's actually an amazingly radical option, an option which insists on holding on to a kind of optimism, but not a woolly-minded optimism that just says, oh, well, everything's bound to be okay, but rather one which is engaging fantastically with alternative possibilities, with the idea that maybe a local community, as in Passport to Pimlico, might determine the destiny of a region in London, rather than simply acquiescing to those in Whitehall who ostensibly hold power. And I think that much of that capacity to dream about how things might be rebuilt is absolutely determined by the fact that these narratives are happening amongst rubble.
And it's really interesting. I mean, even as you were saying that, I was just kind of thinking, I'm growing up with television sitcoms of the 70s and 80s, where it's less daring to do that, but it's kind of built on the shoulders of what Ealing was putting down at that point. I love loads of these sitcoms of the 70s and 80s, but that notwithstanding, it was simpler to do that on television. It was daring to do it on cinema. Can I ask you then, before we dig into the two films specifically, about 1949, a period of time where three particular films were being made at the same time and released, if I've got this right, within two, three months of each other?
It was a year in which three of the very greatest Ealing comedies were produced. Whiskey Galore, directed by Alexander McKendrick, Passport to Pimlico, directed by Henry Cornelius, and Kind Hearts and Coronets, directed by Robert Hamer. One thing that I should say, sometimes that year is described as though Ealing had found its formula. Ealing had worked out how to make comedy, and so it made these three comedies that were quite similar. When I watch them, I think they are staggeringly different from each other.
Yeah.
And I think that really the exciting thing was that Michael Balkan, who is often described in slightly small-c conservative terms, actually had the courage, had the audacity to trust the creative imaginations of these very different, disparate people who were coming with their plans for these films, to trust them enough to say, yeah, go ahead and make them. And actually, what's really miraculous about that year was not that they made the same very good comedy three times and in three slightly different ways, but the fact that they made three absolutely breathtakingly innovative and very different comedies.
So let's dig into them. Let's go with Kind Hearts and Coronets, because you've teased us a few things about that film. Can you introduce us to that?
The most straightforward way to introduce the film is to say that it's a comedy about a genteel serial killer. And yes, it is.
What a sentence.
Yeah. And what an extraordinary, outrageous idea. And it's worth saying that Michael Balkan, when he was first presented with the idea, said, I don't know how I feel about making a comedy about a serial killer. I think this might be a bad idea.
Yeah.
And we should also bear in mind that this is 1949, just 4 years after the end of conflict, yeah, after the end of a war in which almost everybody, if not everybody in the country, had been touched with extraordinary, excruciating grief, where death was not obviously something to take lightly and to laugh at. It's based on a novel called Israel Rank, but the film takes all sorts of liberties with the source novel. Fundamentally, it's about a young man, Louis Mazzini, who is the product of a marriage between an aristocratic woman and an Italian opera singer who was certainly not of her class. Her aristocratic family disapproved so much of the match that they effectively exiled her. And at some point when she and Louis, her son, long after his father, her husband, has died, are living in rather straitened circumstances, they reach out to the family, to the Dascoigne family, asking them for support. And the Dascoigne family say in no uncertain terms that no support will be coming. Louis decides that the only sensible way to deal with this problem is to become Duke himself by killing the 8 people who stand between him and the title.
You'll be the 6th Dascoigne that I've killed. You want to know why? In return for what the Dascoignes did to my mother. Because she married for love instead of for rank or money or land. They condemned her to a life of poverty and slavery in a world with which they had not equipped her to deal. You yourself refused to grant her dying wish, which was to be buried here at Chalfont. When I saw her poor little coffin slide underground, saw her exiled in death, she'd been in life, I swore to have my revenge on your intolerable pride.
Those 8 characters, there's something particularly remarkable about who happens to play them all as well.
There is indeed. Yes, they are all played. I repeat, all played by Alec Guinness. Now, of course, if any actor in the post-war period of British cinema was going to be able to pull this off, it was Alec Guinness. But it is an extraordinary tour de force.
I remember, as I was growing up, the story of Alec Guinness was he was just fed up being asked about Star Wars because of all the other work he'd done that a generation just seemed particularly unaware of. And yet reading about Kind Hearts and Coronets, the story that I saw was when the script was originally presented to him, he was down to play, was it 4 characters?
That's right.
And it was Guinness's idea to just basically double his workload.
Yes, if 4 characters, why not 8?
Why not 12?
Well, that's exactly it. I mean, I just said make it into a long series. Let's have a franchise. We could have dozens of characters.
So we've got Alec Guinness playing multiple characters, but you mentioned Douglas Slocum before, who I think is pivotal to this film, not least a moment of technical ingenuity where we see Guinness in, is it right, 6 characters on screen at the same time?
That's right, absolutely. They're in a church at the funeral of one of the members of the family who has been dispatched.
Spoilers.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry, listener. So Alec Guinness is sitting in the church in 5 stalls and a pulpit.
Yeah.
And in order to pull off this piece of film magic, the camera had to be kept absolutely still while Alec Guinness would go off, change costume, come back, and they would shoot the next character. And this required Douglas Slocum to sleep on set overnight so that he would wake and beat anyone away who was risking moving the camera even by a millimeter, because the slightest movement and the shot would simply not work. As it is, the shot is glorious. It is one of those moments in cinema that makes you want to cheer. There's a particularly happy point when one Alec Guinness taps another Alec Guinness who has started snoring.
The occasion was interesting in that it provided me with my first sight of the Dascoignes en masse. There was the Duke. There was my employer, Lord Ascoigne Dascoigne. There was Admiral Lord Horatio Dascoigne. There was General Lord Rufus Dascoigne. say I was Lady Agatha Descoigne. And in the pulpit, talking interminable nonsense, the Reverend Lord Henry Descoigne.
The life cut short was one rich in achievement and promise of service to humanity.
I mean, Douglas Slocum, you talked about versatility. By the 80s, he was shooting Raiders of the Lost Ark. Just the variety of the amount of work he tackled throughout his career.
That's right. Yeah, a long career, a glittering career, and as you say, a career of extraordinary variety.
And so that's Kind Hearts and Coronets. And then we've got another treat to talk about, the Lavender Hill Mob. So, I mean, what a joy of a question this is for you. Introduce the Lavender Hill Mob for us.
The Lavender Hill Mob, another film with a tour de force performance from Alec Guinness.
And Sid James.
And Sid James. One should never forget Sid James.
Never forget Sid James.
It's a real joy seeing Sid James pre-Carry On.
Yes.
And realising that he's a lot more than dirty old man with a seedy laugh.
Yeah.
Which he does very well. There are pleasures to be derived from the Carry On films. But he's really a very fine comic actor.
And a generous, if you go to something like Hancock's Half Hour, a very generous one as well.
In fact, the cast generally in the Lavender Hill Mob is wonderful. Earlier on, you were asking about the key personnel, the figures who recur in the films of Ealing. And it's important to mention the actors, the performers. There is a kind of repertory company, including lots of actors who take many small parts. A figure like Edie Martin, for example, who has a wonderful diminutive stature and wonderful expressive face, who plays a series of old ladies and particularly old landladies, as she does in the Lavender Hill Mob and the Man in the White Suit, where she will break your heart. Even as you laugh, you will be weeping with Edie Martin. So The Lavender Hill Mob is one of these films that's rich with cameos and small parts. Alec Guinness plays a bank clerk who works for the Bank of England, whose name is Holland. And he describes himself as a non-entity. And really, that is precisely what he is. He is a kind of an absence. And he turns up to work every day and he does his duties responsibly. And everybody thinks him boring, but reliable. His particular job is to oversee the transportation of gold bars when they are being moved from one site to another. But he has dreamed, as non-entities so often do, he has dreamed of other possibilities, of other lives. And those other lives really depend on his finding a way to steal some of those gold bars. And then one night in his boarding house, a new tenant arrives, played by the wonderful Stanley Holloway. And this tenant, Pendlebury, he and Holland strike up an immediate rapport. And after a relatively short time, Holland proposes an outrageous scheme. Because Pendlebury's work has put an idea into Holland's head. Holland has already planned how to steal the gold. But his real problem has been how to transport the gold out of Britain once it is stolen. But it just so happens that Pendlebury runs a souvenir manufacturing firm where he makes what he himself describes as cultural depravities, namely little souvenir statuettes, for example, of the Eiffel Tower. And these are then sent to the sites, including sites outside of Britain, to be sold. So what if, having stolen the gold, they melt it down using Pendlebury's own foundry and refashion it as Eiffel Towers and then ship it out of the country? And so we begin with a kind of heist film, a comedy heist film. They have to enlist the support of some real professional criminals, namely Sid James and Alfie Bass, and they perform the robbery more or less perfectly. But at that point, as was almost inevitably going to be the case, things begin to go wrong. But they go wrong very, very funnily. And I would say that many commentators have argued that the end of the film is rather conservative. I would argue that it is blissfully unstable, indeterminate, outrageous. I think that this is a deeply subversive film.
One of my favourite bits is one of the smaller moments in it. And it's one of my favourite bits of Alec Guinness acting as well. It's never the one they use in any of the clips or anything like that. But it's when they try and promote him. And it's just the look on the man's face as he's just trying to hold it all together. I just love that moment in the film.
Yeah, absolutely. It is glorious. This is just before he's really planning to commit the robbery. And suddenly he really has a few days to steal this gold or he's going to have missed the chance.
Don't look so worried, man. I managed to persuade the chief cashier to give you a leg up.
A leg up, sir?
Promotion. You're going up to foreign exchange. No more uncomfortable journeys in that dreary van.
But, sir...
Now, nonsense, nonsense, nonsense. Don't bother to thank me, man. I've told Abercrombie that you can start with him next Monday.
But I can't, sir.
Why not?
Because I'm too old to change my views now, sir.
One's never too old. Better oneself. Think what you can do with an extra 15 shillings a week.
But, sir, I like the bullion office. It holds all I ever wished for.
The trouble with you, Holland, if I may speak frankly, is that you haven't enough ambition. When a good opportunity comes along, grab it with both hands. It may not occur again.
Very good, sir. I'll follow your advice.
Alec Guinness is a performer whose subtlety, I think, sometimes can be overwhelmed by other performers. But in this film, it works magnificently. There is a subtlety and even a kind of an enigmatic quality to his performance throughout, which is just mesmerizing. In the final scene, there is a smile that plays on Alec Guinness's face, which complicates everything. He is a master of a particular kind of comedy. And for me, The Lavender Hill Mob is his finest hour. I think it is better than his performance in Kind Hearts and Corrie.
Interesting. I should recommend his diaries as well are excellent, excellent reading.
Absolutely.
If I've got a favourite bit of trivia on The Lavender Hill Mob, perhaps you can tell me if this is right or not. The Bank of England was involved in plotting the scheme. Is there truth to that?
Yes, you see, these were the good old days when... When you were a film writer, absolutely, and you were researching something.
Rob all your gold.
That's right. You wouldn't just kind of, you know, go online and look up something. You'd think, well, I want to steal gold from the Bank of England, so who should I ask? Well, the Bank of England. And so, yes, Tibby Clark, the writer, turned up at the Bank of England and said, I'd like to speak to somebody about how to steal some gold, which, of course, set off some alarm bells, metaphorically at least, in the minds of the people that he was speaking to. But having said that he was representing Ealing Studios, they ushered him in and gave him all the information he needed. So this was a heist film with the seal of approval of the Bank of England itself.
Hello, all cars from M2GW. This is number 48 begins. Maroon-coloured van LJL638, containing bullion value £1 million, stolen from the vicinity of Queen Victoria Street.
A lot of your own research as well looks at how normative films can be queered. And I just wonder, can you explain what you mean by this and how that might relate to some of Ealing's work?
Yes, absolutely. I'd point out that in The Lavender Hill Mob, when Holland and Pendlebury make their first Eiffel Tower from gold, they cradle it, look down lovingly at it and say, our firstborn. This is a pair of men who holiday together in Paris. This is a pair of men who live together in a boarding house. This is a pair of men who embrace each other with sheer unadulterated joy on their face at every opportunity. There is an intimacy to their, what we might think of as homosocial engagement. Now, it's very important that I'm not trying to insist that they are a gay couple. I'm really not trying to do that. But I'm trying to say that it is exploring the ways in which relationships were beginning to shift in this post-war moment. There was a kind of an intimacy between men which survived the end of conflict. If you think about the experiences which men had undergone together, the extraordinary emotional intensity of fighting alongside each other, that was retained in all sorts of ways in the post-war moment. This is a moment when gender and indeed sexual desire are being redefined culturally. And I think there's something of that in the film. But alongside that, I'd say queer isn't just about finding representation of particular identities. It's also about the destabilization of certain assumptions, certain obviousnesses, certain ideological, apparently self-evident norms. And I think in all sorts of ways, The Lavender Hill Mob is just playing mischievously with those. First of all, there is the fact that I can't imagine a viewer who gets to the end of the film and isn't entirely rooting for the mob. So there is this idea that we're aligned with criminals. We're aligned with people whose response to the need for redistribution of power and wealth in the post-war moment is to nick some gold. And we're with them. We're championing them. And who are the bad guys? If not bad guys, who are the ridiculous, rather unsettling and unsavory figures? The police and schoolgirls. So these figures who we might characteristically expect a conservative studio like Ealing Studios to be rooting for, no, they are pretty loathsome. The people that we love are those who are behaving antisocially. And for me, the moment of this film, which I think, even if the rest of the film somehow, for some reason, ceased to exist, if this sequence alone survived, it would still deserve to be in the pantheon of great British films, is the sequence on the Eiffel Tower. They arrive in Paris and discover, much to their horror, that some of the gold Eiffel Towers have inadvertently been sold to some English schoolgirls and are right now descending the Eiffel Tower in the lift. And without hesitation, Holland starts running down the spiral staircase down the centre of the Eiffel Tower. Pendlebury, with some hesitation, follows. And as they run, Pendlebury suddenly starts to laugh. And Holland looks back and shouts, "There is nothing to laugh at." And then he too starts to laugh. And for me, and many may disagree with me, but for me, there is almost nothing imaginable queerer than saying, when everything is collapsing, when all of the logic and the things that we have been pinning everything on, when they start to crumble, what do? You do something as perverse as laughing. It is a joyful, ecstatic moment. And it also creates this glorious sense of unity between the two men as they share this bizarre, outrageous, implausible moment. And for me, it speaks of, for want of a better term, a kind of love between them.
There's nothing to laugh at.
Now then, with Kind Hearts and Coronets, I mean, in some ways, this is an assault on what we might think of as family values. It's strange to me that figures with whom I am in as little sympathy as Margaret Thatcher and John Major have said that this kind of post-war cinema is exactly the kind of film that they love because it sums up the nice pre-permissive moments of the 1960s. It precedes them. And this is when Britain was still innocent, when Britain still held on to Victorian values. My God, there's nothing Victorian about the values in Kind Hearts and Coronets. This is a film in which family is pretty loathsome, and in which a man who, in all sorts of ways, his sexual desires are extraordinary and multiple and fluid, where he simply dispatches those who are in his way. And notice this casting of Alec Guinness in multiple roles in the family. What does that suggest about the family? It suggests that families are just monstrous repetitions. It's just the same person churned out over and over and over again. The inescapable logic of biological reproduction. This is suggesting that something else might be better. Introduce a bit of Italian operatic alternative.
I think you quite like these films, Benedict.
I can't even begin to sum up how much I love these films. And one thing that I would also really like to point out is that every year I teach these films, and every year I watch the undergraduates walking in, and they resemble the shot at the very beginning of the Lavender Hill Mob when you see commuters walking across London Bridge. They look miserable beyond belief. How can this man be making us watch black and white films from the 1940s and early 50s? This is obscene. And then to hear the laughter and to see them come out in love with these films, they capture the imagination in ways which is so heartening. These are films which stand up not only as extraordinary exercises in technique, but also as comedy which simply, despite being very much of its moment, transcends that moment and remains extraordinarily relevant, dynamic, and most importantly, of course, funny.
So before we let you go back out into the wide world, one of the things we like to ask as well is just if you can recommend us a double bill from deeper within the Studio Canal catalogue.
I've been slightly dreading this question, but absolutely.
Good.
I know that you like to make your guests squirm and feel slightly uncomfortable. The reason that I dread it is only because the Studio Canal catalogue is just extraordinary. Almost every film that might be in your list of favourite films will be in this catalogue. It is phenomenal. Of course, they hold the rights to the Ealing comedies, and therefore I love so many of the films in it. But I have deviated from Ealing for my double
bill. Okay, you've gone rogue.
I have gone rogue.
Okay.
The first is Belle de Jour.
Okay.
By Louis Buñuel. A remarkable film with one of the great performances from the history of cinema, I think, from Catherine Deneuve as Séverine, a film about a respectable bourgeois woman who becomes a sex worker in the afternoon and the repercussions of this. It being Buñuel, there are, of course, not only satirical elements, but also surreal elements to the film. I want to pair this with
Apocalypse Now.
Yeah, that's another good one. With The Bells of St. Trinian.
Oh, okay.
Now, part of the reason
now,
I want to do
this is schoolgirls on the Eiffel Tower, isn't it?
They're not
that's
on the Eiffel Tower.
They're not in that, but
no,
that's your...
that's right. I do love... I love a schoolgirl British comedy. First of all, there is the happy coincidence of the plural bells in the titles of these films. But also, more importantly, I think both of them plays with ideas of anarchy, with surrealism, with resistance to patriarchal norms. These are films which simply take the kind of dogmatic insistence that women behave in a particular way and explode them.
Gracious me, I thought hockey was a game, but with you girls, it's more like jungle warfare. Lucretia, hold this thing taut at the back. Girls! Girls! Amanda! Come back! You never saw such girls! Come back this minute!
They're also both blessed with extraordinary enigmatic central performances. Catherine Deneuve's, as I've already mentioned, in Belle de Jour, but in Bells of St. Trinian's, the magnificent Alistair Sim,
yes,
who plays both Millicent Fritton, the headmistress of St. Trinian's, and her ne'er-do-well brother, Clarence. And this double performance allows Alistair Sim to stand beside himself, to be multiple, to be fractured, to be extraordinarily and ambiguously unstable for us as we watch. In Belle de Jour, I think that Catherine Deneuve also gives a double performance in all sorts of ways. It's significant that her character is called Séverine, etymologically linked to ideas of severing, to splitting, to dividing. She is a woman whose life is divided. She is leading a double life. So for all those reasons, and of course principally because they're just both beautiful films, I would recommend Belle de Jour and The Bells of St. Trinian's as your double bill.
Benedict Morrison, thank you very much.
My absolute pleasure. Thank you for having me.
Both The Lavender Hill Mob and Kind Hearts and Coronets will debut on 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray in April 2024. They're also both available on the Studio Canal Presents channel on Prime Video, Apple TV Plus and ITVX. You can also find both Belle de Jour and The Bells of St. Trinian's on the Studio Canal Presents channel. Now it's time for our regular news update from the world of Studio Canal. The 23rd film from British filmmaking legend Mike Leigh is arriving later this year, and we've got a few more details about it. It's called Hard Truths and will be set in the present day, having been shot around London last year. Furthermore, even though the film has been made under Lee's usual secretive conditions, we now know that Marianne Jean-Baptiste is reuniting with him for the film. The pair worked together on 1996's Secrets and Lies, for which Jean-Baptiste earned an Oscar nomination. We'll have more on Hard Truths in a future episode of the podcast. Anyone fancy some sharks? Something in the Water looks set to be a slice of summer fun landing in UK cinemas. It pits five women against a shark that's got a bit of an appetite. Hayley Easton Street directs, Kat Clark has written the script, and here's a bite from the trailer ahead of the film's release on the 5th of July. In terms of physical media, a few more 4K Ultra HD Blu-ray titles are on the horizon. Set for May, three new releases have been lined up, all making their debut on the format in the UK. There's Train to Busan, which we've covered before on this very podcast, along with its 2020 standalone sequel Peninsula, that and Duncan Jones' second film, the 2011 sci-fi action thriller Source Code. Finally, just one last reminder that Back to Black, the story of the legendary Amy Winehouse, is arriving in UK cinemas on April the 12th, a week or two
after this podcast lands. I'll be back soon with the next episode of Studio Canal Presents. Until the next time, to get all the news on Studio Canal films as it happens, and to find out more about the ITVX, Apple TV and Prime Video channels, you can visit www.studiocanal.co.uk or follow Studio Canal at Studio Canal UK on X, Instagram and TikTok. For now, I'm off to start plotting a daring heist, hopefully with a bit of help from the Bank of England. Ta-ta for now.